Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is Dr. Peter Kozlowski on food sensitivities, fixing leaky gut, and how to do an elimination diet correctly. This is one of these podcasts that if you have a history of gut issues, food sensitivities, or have anything around the area of food allergies, you're going to learn loads from this episode and get so much from it. If that's you, I'd highly recommend a pen and a piece of paper for this one. If you fall outside of that scope or you don't really have any history of gut issues, you have no issue with food sensitivities, you're still going to learn a lot from today's podcast because Dr. Kozlowski can speak to a lot of different areas around functional medicine, but I definitely would recommend this one for those of you who have a history similar to me, but backstory of gut issues, IBS, leaky gut, etc. There's so much in today's podcast. Some of the things we touch on, the most important lifestyle and diet changes you can make to heal your gut once and for all, how to do a food elimination diet correctly, the 21-day protocols and tracking journal. This is an absolute must for anyone that is trying to potentially see where their food sensitivities are or food allergies are, and food sensitivities and why they're so common, leaky gut, the causes and how to fix it, and much more. So much in this podcast. Really enjoyed it personally as somebody who has a history of gut issues and is particularly interested in this topic. So without further ado, here is Dr. Peter Kozlowski on food sensitivities, fixing leaky gut, and how to do an elimination diet correctly. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Dr. Peter Kozlowski. Dr. Kozlowski is an entrepreneurial functional medicine doctor who trained at the centers of Drs. Mark Hyman, Deepak Chopra, and Susan Bloom. He began applying functional medicine principles while working with underserved populations in Chicago during his family medicine residency. Dr. Kozlowski uses a broad array of tools to find the source of the body's dysfunction. He takes the time to listen to his patients and plot their history on a timeline, considering what makes them unique and co-creating with them an individualized care plan. His recently published book, Unfunk Your Gut, encapsulates his collaborative patient-first healthcare approach in true research-based conversational style. It offers a blend of medical insight and the experimental wisdom of his own healing journey through addiction recovery. I'm looking forward to talking all things health in today's episode. Dr. Kozlowski, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's such an honor to be here.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation because there's so many topics that I want to explore today. But before we do that, talk to us a little bit about your backstory and kind of what got you down the route of functional medicine.
Yeah, so I would have never dreamed that I'd be in functional medicine. It's not the way I was raised or trained. I was very traditional. And most physicians like me, medical doctors that get into functional medicine do it because they get sick, right? They end up with lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or some other kind of unexplained disease. They can't figure it out with their regular medical training, so they find functional medicine. For me, my story is different. I have had a disease or have a disease, but it was more of a mental health disease. So I grew up very much a binge drinker. I loved to drink on the weekends, and I drank starting when I was like 12 years old. And I tried to stop when I was in my first year of residency, which I would think I was 28. And within a week, I kind of knew I was screwed. I had no idea how to deal with life. And so I tried to like white knuckle it, as they say. And I mean, I'd never even thought I had a problem with alcohol. I wouldn't call myself an alcoholic. I was extremely successful. I had just gotten through medical school into residency, was doing great, but I didn't know how to manage life without alcohol. And so I lasted for a while, and eventually I ended up taking a break from residency for 6 weeks to go to a treatment program for alcohol abuse. And my opinion of like who an alcoholic was changed dramatically because I thought it was somebody that was living under the bridge. And I was there with all these other doctors and professionals. And I was like, what are you guys doing here? So that experience, that 6 weeks of treatment had nothing to do with alcohol. It was all about why, right? Like, why did I drink? Why did I need to do it? And just a brief why, what I learned is I was never secure in my own skin. I grew up extremely insecure. My parents are from Poland. I was born in the U.S. and grew up in the U.S. But we were always different. And I just never felt like I fit in, even though I was popular in school, had everything going for me. I created trauma. And when I was very young, I found alcohol, and alcohol took away all those insecurities. So I made it to 28 without, like, even, I couldn't even tell you an emotion or a feeling that I had when I was 28. It was either happy or angry. So I went through that treatment for myself, and I went back to residency. And when you're a resident, you get trained by different attending doctors. And so every attending doctor has a different style, and every week they change. So you're constantly learning, like, somebody else's different opinion. And we had one doctor that every time we had patients hospitalized, he would start a multivitamin and vitamin D with them. And we were the residents, so we had to do the scut work, which was doing the orders, calling in the prescription, starting the vitamins. And he was the only one that did it, so we thought it was a joke. Like, we literally made fun of him. And one day, I mean, after I went through treatment, we were on call together. It was like 2 a.m. on a Sunday night. And his name's Dr. Batra. And I was like, Dr. Batra, what are you doing? Like, why are you weird? And he's like, I'm studying something called functional medicine. And he took me to the website, and he's like, it's all about root cause, right? And why someone's sick. So not treating the symptoms, but treating the underlying cause. And it just made sense. I was like, that sounds interesting. And we were required to do continuing medical education during residency. So I signed up for functional medicine, like the general conference. And within the first hour of being there, like, I knew that my life could never be the same. It was all taught from a biochemistry, from anatomy, from a physiology level. Like, it all made sense. And I was just shocked, like, how did I not learn this? So I spent a lot of time and a lot of money to learn just a different way of thinking. And I mean, it's complete random luck. Like, I would have never, ever dreamed that I'd be like an alternative medicine doctor. It's kind of shocking.
It's fantastic, though. And when I see the likes of you, Peter, and others out there who are promoting functional medicine, like, it's one of the best things I can see. Again, it's so far outside my realm as somebody that works with people as a nutritionist and as a personal trainer and their fitness. But having this root, looking for the root problem, whether it's, you know, chronic illness or whether it's just an issue somebody has, I think is so important, as opposed to just treating the symptom, you know, the symptomatic treatment of what can be prescribed to most of the Western world at this point. So I'm so grateful for that you're able to promote this message out there, which gives me a nice little segue where I'm going to fast forward now into your book, where, you know, you wrote Unfunk Your Gut. Before we kind of do a deeper dive into that, who did you write the book for?
I wrote it for my patients, I'd say. My patients and the things that I've seen over the last 10 years of practicing functional medicine. I'm a perfectionist, which is great in a lot of ways, but it's really hard on me in a lot of ways. I only remember, like, I'm very hard on myself, and I only remember the patients that didn't get better. And so over the years, I kept putting stuff together, like, what, you know, learning from patients and learning from different treatment plans and et cetera. So I wrote it for people that are out there struggling, for a message of hope. Like, as someone who's been to rock bottom and thought there was no way out, there is a way out. And for my rock bottom is different than a lot of my patients, because I don't work with people. I mean, I work with people in a, like, recovery, but that's not the focus of my practice. I work with people with chronic disease who have been to 6, 7, 15 doctors and have just been told, like, we have no clue why this is happening. And, you know, just keep taking these meds until they stop working, and then we'll take these other ones. And so I just wrote it. I mean, what has helped my recovery journey is a lot of, like, spiritual books. And I just always loved to read. And, you know, I wanted to write something that could make, I think that one of our problems in our society is that we make medicine and health really difficult. We make it very extreme, and it doesn't have to be. Like, it's obviously complicated, but keeping it simple helps me a lot, and I think that's helped my patients a lot. So I've read most of the functional medicine books written, and the majority of them are very, very scientific, which is great, and mine is scientific. But mine is also like very low key. Like chapter one is why you should stay off the internet. And I Googled abdominal pain and I went through like all the different things I convinced myself from using Google to try to diagnose myself. And it's pretty funny. I mean, most people when they read it are laughing out loud. And but then it's also just all science based and it gives people a way to start healing without even seeing me. I think that our job as practitioners, our most important job is education. And whenever I've met with a new patient over the last 10 years, the first visit is always education. And that takes us so far. And so I've put all of that into my book. So I would say that it's just for the average person that's struggling.
When you kind of take on the Pandora's box of something like the gut, you know, and I you can go in a whole host of different directions potentially with this one, but when it comes to say important lifestyle or diet changes that you can make to heal your gut, what would be some of those? Because there's a lot of people who have listened to this podcast who know the importance of the gut, either for those who struggle with, you know, actual issues with their gut, whether it's, you know, leaky gut or IBS or just stomach issues, on top of, you know, food absorption and the whole host of benefits that can come from mental health, but, you know, the serotonin production in the gut, etc. What are some of the lifestyle or diet changes that you recommend to people when it comes to actually fixing or healing their gut?
It starts with food. And it starts with identifying whether or not you have food sensitivities. And that is when your body reacts to food, your body, you can create an allergy, you can have celiac disease, or you can have a sensitivity. Allergies and celiac disease are really easy to work with because the regular medical community believes in them. There's really reliable testing. And the reaction happens right after you eat the food. So you don't make it to 40 years old without knowing that you're allergic to peanuts, right? Sensitivities are what we work with. And sensitivities, they are, even though they won't kill you right away like an allergy could, to me, they're more dangerous. And that's because the reaction is delayed hours to days after eating the food. So I could eat a bagel every day for breakfast or a bowl of cereal every day for breakfast, right? And my body is sensitive to gluten or dairy. And I have no idea, right? Because I feel fine. I have my breakfast, I go on with my day, and I'm fine. But I suffer from chronic migraines, or I suffer from chronic eczema, or I suffer from some kind of chronic autoimmune disease. And I have no clue that it's what I'm eating that's setting off the inflammation that's creating that disease. Because I don't feel sick after eating it. So the reaction is delayed hours to days after eating the food. And then the other problem with sensitivities is there's not reliable testing. So there's a lot of lab companies out there that run IgG food panels, and that's the type of antibody that's created. So when you're allergic, you have an IgE antibody. When you have celiac, IgA antibody, and sensitivity, IgG antibody. The IgG food panels, they can test like 200 foods, but most people that have done those tests, they're typically just a log of what you've been eating for the last few months. And that's because of leaky gut, which we can talk about. But a food sensitivity test is basically just a test of leaky gut. And the way that you diagnose yourself of any food sensitivities is an elimination diet, which is 21 days of cutting out the biggest offending foods and then adding them back in one by one using a tracking journal. So the first thing that I thought of when I heard of this, I was like, why 21 days? Like, where did they come up with this number? It seems kind of just random. Everything in your body has a half-life, right? So if you drink alcohol, if you take prescription meds, your hormones, lead, mercury, mold toxins, everything has a half-life, and that's how long it takes your body to get rid of half of it. And the half-life of IgG antibodies is about 21 days. So if I had a bagel today and I'm sensitive to gluten, I have 100 antibodies against gluten floating around. If I completely avoid gluten for 21 days, my immune response will be cut in half to 50. On day 22, I eat it again, gluten. And my immune system, if it's recognized that gluten protein as an invader, it'll attack, which creates inflammation in the blood. And that's the most important thing that I like to teach people about their guts is the gut's most important job is to decide what comes into your body and what stays out. The gut is a long tube that starts with the mouth and ends with the anus. There are openings on both ends. The inside of your gut is outside of your body. So when gluten gets through the gut barrier and into your blood, the immune system attacks if it's identified it as an invader. And now you've got inflammation in the bloodstream. And what happens with your bloodstream? It goes everywhere from your head to your toes, right? And so that's why you could take 100 people with a dairy sensitivity or soy or corn, and everybody tells you they have a different reaction. And that's because the inflammation got into the body through the gut, and then it's just circulating anywhere. So another important thing for people to understand is that definitely, like, I've worked with so many patients over the years that don't have any gut symptoms, but they've got some kind of other chronic disease that is healed through healing their gut.
What would an example of that be? I've got several questions, so I don't want to stay too long on that because you've given me so many different things that I want to unpack. But what would be an example of something where there's no gut symptoms that you would go back to heal through the gut in terms of an illness?
The best one, I think, is the skin, any kind of skin issues. So the skin, I always say, is the best representation of your gut. So if you've got somebody with hives or eczema, rashes, I would start with the gut. Thyroid disease, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, brain fog, headaches, joint pain. I mean, I could pick anything.
It's so interesting. It's, again, it's one of those topics that you can go a mile deep on any one, but I want to pull it back to the elimination diets just because I think you've given so much value to people there that, you know, you have to give your 21 days, your 3 weeks, and use a tracking journal. What would be some of the mistakes people make with an elimination diet? I know one that I've made myself, Peter, is that I've eliminated too many foods at once, so I didn't actually know what was the trigger food, which sounds, you know, stupid when I say it in hindsight, because you obviously have to remove the single food to test it, but I removed dairy and gluten and sugar all at once, so I didn't know what any of the foods were when I was trying to fix issues with my stomach and my gut. But what are some of the common mistakes people make when it comes to testing elimination diets?
I would say the two most important things of the elimination diet is being 100% strict. Like, if you make it to day 14 and then you accidentally have some dairy, you have to start over. Because that inflammatory response, we've lost that half-life, and that inflammatory response has been elevated again. And then the other one is just not doing the proper reintroduction. So we do cut out, like in our elimination diet, we cut out gluten, dairy, soy, corn, eggs, sugar, shellfish, beef, pork, coffee, alcohol, and then we add them back in.
Oh, that's interesting. So you would pull them all out at once and then reintroduce. Okay, that's interesting.
One by one. So it's going to be starting on day 22, you're going to pick whatever food you're missing the most. So the order doesn't matter. Like, if your favorite food is tofu, you can start with tofu, right? Even though, like, the most common sensitivities are gluten and dairy. But the order doesn't matter. So on day 22, you eat 3 servings of that food, basically like breakfast, lunch, dinner. And then you keep a tracking journal. And you write down basically, okay, today I had soy and I had a headache, or my stomach got upset. We're not necessarily looking for a reaction that, like, let's say you went into the elimination diet because of migraines, you could reintroduce soy and end up with abdominal pain. And that's still a reaction, and it could be still the underlying cause of your migraines. So one food every 2 days. So day 23, nothing new. So if you did soy on day 22, 3 times that day, you wait the next day. If nothing happened, then on day 24, you start the next food. And you systematically, so a elimination diet is 21 days, but if to do it properly is like 5 to 6 weeks, because you have to go step by step reintroducing the foods. And a lot of times people like make it to day 21 and be like, all right, screw it, I'm having some ice cream. And then you have no clue. And that's a lot of, like, the whole 30 diets are great. People feel great, but then they don't get that data about what they're sensitive to. So a new food every 2 days, that part of it is probably the most crucial part of the elimination diet that a lot of people don't do correctly.
That's so useful and so helpful. And I feel significantly better now that you said that, removing all those foods, because that's what I did. It was trial and error on my part. I hands up, have to say that I was doing it myself, which isn't the best way. You should work with a professional, for people listening, just to kind of add that caveat. Peter, why do you think food sensitivities are so common now? And as somebody that has struggled with this for as long as I can remember, definitely through my teenage years, you know, I've been through the test for celiac disease, and then came back as, you know, non-celiac gluten sensitive, in terms of it's a food that bothers me, and dairy, those foods all bother me. So I just have eliminated them. And for the last 10 years, I haven't eaten them or consumed them at all. So for the most part, I don't think about it too much anymore. But there's a lot of people listening who are at the early part of their journey, still consuming those foods that sensitive to or intolerant to or can't digest well for whatever reason, and they're struggling. And obviously the elimination diet is a tool to potentially work through what's actually causing the issue. But why do you think food sensitivities are so common now?
So the reason I think food sensitivities are rising so much is because of what we're doing to our food supply and our guts. And we are constantly messing with our food, right? The hybridization of wheat started in the 1960s, genetic modification of soy and corn, cows stopped roaming in grass fields and started eating genetically modified foods, that hay and some of these other products. And we're injecting the animals with all these antibiotics, and like chickens are injected with arsenic so they grow bigger. So the proteins of all these foods have changed over the last 30, 40 years. And the one thing that they never did was test that on human beings. Like, how would we respond to proteins that look different? That, I think, is why they're on the rise, because our immune system's job is to identify things that are invaders and things that are not. And what previously a food like a dairy protein like whey or casein that looked normal now looks different and now looks like an invader. And so the immune system, I think, is actually, I mean, it's a crappy response because it sucks to have food sensitivities, but it's actually like a very appropriate response of your body trying to protect you. So that, I think, is a major reason why. And the other one is our gut health. And like I said, our gut is a barrier to let things in and out. And when we lose that barrier, which is leaky gut, due to things like antibiotics, antidepressants, ibuprofen, NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, sugar, our diet sodas, stress. And so our barrier is lost. So not only is our environment more toxic, but the gut is also leakier than it used to be. So that combination of things, I think, is just making this issue really kind of rampant.
When it comes to healing leaky gut then, because it's something that so many people struggle with, I know a lot of people who are long-term listeners to the podcast have had issues with their gut at some point, whether it was from medication, like you mentioned, antibiotics, whether it's from food, too much sugar. In my case, you know, just consuming things that completely nuked my gut, between the food sensitivities and pushing through in my early 20s to, you know, way too many supplements and different medicines that I would, you know, treating symptomatic issues as opposed to looking to the root cause. How or what would be some of the first steps towards healing your gut then? Obviously the elimination diet when it comes to food, but what would be the next layer on top of that pyramid then?
So I would say that the next layer after identifying food sensitivities is to make sure that you're digesting. And a simple way that, so what we talk, the first thing that I talk about with digestion is stomach acid. Your stomach, when food drops into it, releases hydrochloric acid. Hydrochloric acid is how you digest protein, how you get vitamins and minerals out of your food, how you kill off all these bad bacteria and viruses and parasites that we're being exposed to, and then absorb those nutrients once they get into the small intestine. So we need lots of stomach acid. The seventh most prescribed drug in America is an acid blocker. And I think that that's a worldwide problem, where the number one tool in a GI doctor's tool belt is an acid blocker, right?
Yeah, that's what I was put on as well for nearly a year and a half before I started to look for the root cause. So just to give you more context, right, to what you're saying.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's that's their tool, right? And so anybody like you and pretty much anybody that goes to a GI doctor is like, all right, you have inflammation, you need an acid blocker. Well, when you block acid, you're blocking your digestion of protein. You're blocking your body's ability to protect itself from all the toxins in our environment. You're blocking, even if your diet's amazing, right? You're eating 9 to 12 servings of vegetables and fruit a day. But if you're not digesting, you're not absorbing it, right? So it's really, really overdiagnosed, too much stomach acid. It is a real thing. So there are people that do end up making too much stomach acid, and an acid blocker will help them in a very short-term process. But in our medical world, we basically put people on it and they're on it 40 years later if they don't do something different. So low stomach acid is what we test and treat for. And low stomach acid has the same symptoms that too much stomach acid is. So it is indigestion, it's heartburn, it's feeling full, it's nausea after taking supplements, it's low B12 levels, low iron levels. Those are all symptoms of or signs of low stomach acid. And so what we do is test and treat people for low stomach acid. And this is something that your listeners can do tomorrow morning after they listen to this. It's called the baking soda test. And when I heard of this, I thought it was ridiculous. It sounded like a high school chemistry experiment to me. But what you do is you mix a quarter teaspoon of baking soda into a few ounces of water, mix it up and drink it. Baking soda is basic. Your stomach should be acidic. When the base and the acid meet, it creates an explosion and it presents as gas, and you should start burping. So you should burp within 3 to 5 minutes after having the baking soda. If you don't burp, then you probably have low stomach acid. And that's something that if you don't address that, you'll never be able to heal your gut. And it's another thing that you won't really know. There's the traditional medicine, they don't really have a great test for low stomach acid. Some doctors will give you like a robotic pill that you could swallow that like flows through your GI tract and measures the acidity. The baking soda test sounds kind of ridiculous to me, but it's actually remarkably reliable. So that's something that people can do. And the way that you treat it is to supplement hydrochloric acid. It comes in capsules. You can get it from your local supplement store. But the most important thing about supplementing hydrochloric acid is you only take it before eating protein. So if you're just, I usually say in the beginning, just like meat, fish, eggs. If you are just having like a plate of vegetables, I wouldn't take it until you've gotten comfortable with it. And so you take an acid capsule and then you eat. Somebody with normal stomach acid is going to feel bad. They're going to have heartburn. They're going to have burning in their throat. They're going to be like, wow, I have too much acid in my stomach. Somebody with low stomach acid is either going to feel better or not even feel it. It'd be like taking a multivitamin. It's not normal to tolerate HCL supplements. So if you can tolerate it, that means your stomach acid's low. And then you titrate up. You go from 1 to 2, 2 to 3, as high as 7, at some point you will get some reflux symptoms. Let's say that happens after 3, then your treatment dose is 2. And that's what you would be on until you figured out why it's low, which we can talk about why it would be low. So you stay on that as part of like to make sure that you're digesting, because the next part of digestion is coming from your pancreas. Once food and acid get into your small intestine, the pancreas releases enzymes that break down fats, carbs, whatever proteins left over. And those pancreatic enzymes need acid to be activated. So that's a major piece that people miss, but it's crucial. And all this stuff is very, very outlined in my book in case somebody's like, whoa, he's talking too fast. I didn't catch that. There's step-by-step elimination diet. There's step-by-step how to test yourself for low stomach acid, how to treat it. But that's a crucial piece. And a lot of times my patients are like, why didn't my regular doctor tell me about this? And that gets into my belief that traditional medicine is basically taught by the pharmaceutical industry. We are taught what the drug companies want us to know. There are not any medications that increase your stomach acid, but they've got lots of them that block it. And so that's what we're taught as traditional doctors. Well, HCL can be supported through a supplement, through acupuncture, through eating papaya, bromelain. So there's a lot of ways to improve it. But that's a huge one that people miss. That's another thing I wanted to share that can start getting someone's gut right.
Yeah, that's so valuable. And for everybody listening, I'll be linking Unfunk Your Gut, the book, in the show notes. So for anyone that's struggling or that wants to go deeper with this, I highly recommend you pick up the book and start applying it. But Peter, why would the stomach acid be low? You mentioned there that, yeah. You know, what would be some of the reasons for that? I have a complete knowledge gap here to why that would even be. What would be some of the main kind of causes for that?
So the normal reason is aging. And 80% of people over 80 have low stomach acid. Something like 60 over 60 have low stomach acid. I see it in teenagers, young adults all the time. And the number one reason, the gut-brain connection, which is my favorite thing to talk about and what my book is all about, is that your mental, emotional, and spiritual health is the key to your gut health. And that is because your gut and brain are connected, right? And your gut, that tube that we were talking about, has its own nervous system called the enteric nervous system. It is connected to your brain by your vagus nerve. So your brain sends signals to your gut, and your gut sends signals to your brain. And that vagus nerve, that system, runs on your autonomic nervous system, your automatic. So you don't think about it, it's happening. And it can either be in sympathetic response or parasympathetic response. Sympathetic is fight or flight. Parasympathetic is rest and digest. I live in Montana now where we have lots of grizzly bears. So the analogy I give is like, if I'm out hiking in the mountains and I see a grizzly bear, my sympathetic nervous system is activated. The brain, the blood goes to my brain and my muscles so I can survive. If I survive and I make it to the campfire at the end of the night, then I'm in rest and digest. So the signal that's being sent when we're in sympathetic response is do not digest. Do not make stomach acid. Do not let your good bacteria grow. Like all the energy and oxygen is going to your body to survive. And nowadays, especially with pandemics and other things, even before, in my opinion, people are living as if they're running from a bear 24/7, right? We are constantly in fight or flight. There's social media and breaking news and email and text, and you have to reply to everything right away. We're constantly in sympathetic overdrive. Well, when you live like that, you're eating. And your gut's like, okay, I need to digest this food. I need to make stomach acid. But then you're sending a massive blocking signal from the brain that's like, hey, now's not the right time to digest. So that, as my own story of being in recovery and then working with just so many patients over the year, the biggest difference that I see in my patients, whether they heal or don't, and we can pick any condition like candida or SIBO or heavy metal toxins or mold toxins, if they're not making their mental, emotional, spiritual health the focus of their health, they will not get better, because we can give you supplements, you could follow strict diets, but if you're shutting down your brain signal to your gut, you're turning off your gut, it doesn't matter what you're doing. And this is the area that my patients usually are like, you know, go to hell. Like, I don't want to talk about this. This is not an issue for me. But that's the key in my experience. And that's the part that's missed, because the rest of the stuff is easy. So there's other reasons, like antibiotics could screw up your stomach from making acid, environmental toxins like lead and mercury. But in my experience, stomach acid pretty much always comes back when people are addressing that mental, emotional, spiritual component. So those are my opinions why it's so common and so low.
Can you explore that, the mental, emotional and spiritual connection? Because I think, again, one of the reasons that I love your work and I love the message you have is that holistic approach. It's not just, it's like you need to do the elimination diets and you need to manage it and then add in supplements that can potentially support it, but you also have to look at it as a whole. When you say mental, emotional and spiritual, and I know you talk about the kind of the connection to the food and how it influences your health and things like practicing gratitude to aid digestion, but can you explore that for us, what a mental, emotional and spiritual means, and kind of talk through maybe some of the techniques or things that you get your patients to, or that you offer them that could potentially help them? Because I know this is, again, similar to what we mentioned earlier, Pandora's box. It can go in so many different directions. But what are some of the ones that have yielded the most benefits for the people you've worked with?
So this is obviously the most difficult part of health for me to help people with. I mean, luckily I have my own story, so I've been through it. So I know what worked for me, but I think the biggest thing that I like to teach people is you have to find what works for you. Right. And so there's so many different things. And for me, a massive one is exercise. If I get injured and I can't play basketball or go to the weight room or whatever, I give me a couple days and I already see my mental health going downhill. And so I need to exercise. But then there's people out there that will be like, I feel worse after exercise. And so it's finding the right kind, because sometimes people are just using the wrong kind of exercise. That's a big one for me. I've recommended every patient I've ever worked with to get a therapist. And I've worked with therapists for 10 years now. There's a general stigma around, like, if you're going to a therapist that you're nuts. I personally think that we're all crazy. It's just either we're working on it or we're not.
Yeah, I agree with that statement completely.
So, and I worry about people that are like, no, I'm not crazy. Like that, when a patient comes in to see me, they fill out 40 pages of intake paperwork before the visit. And one of the questions on there is, do you have an excess amount of stress in your life? And if they write no, then I know we're in trouble, because we all do, right? And then the follow-up question is, can you easily manage stress? And if they write yes, then that's kind of like the double whammy of like, okay, we got issues here. Because, and granted, that's not everybody. You know, there are maybe people out there that don't have a lot of stress and can manage it easily, but that's not
they're probably not coming into you if they're in a hill in a mountain, right? Somewhere. Yeah, yeah. Or in a cabin. Yeah,
right. So that therapy is something they help you figure out the what and the why, right? Like when I went to treatment, like I felt like I was down, because I was like, I've had a good life. Like, yeah, we were immigrants and things were difficult at times, but like my parents gave me everything they could. And like, I had a very good life. Like, why am I sitting here in rehab? Right. And for me, it was like, I created my own trauma by just not feeling good enough. And that was enough for me. Like and that made it almost more difficult to work on. And so that's where I really feel for people. It's like, unfortunately, like people that have a known trauma of like violence or something like that, it can almost be easier for them to work on it because you can accept it. And when it's minor stuff, it's harder to accept. And that's my experience. The definition of trauma that I really love is, trauma is anything less than nurturing. And that's not a common definition. I don't think most people do think of it as much more extreme. But trauma could be as simple as, you're 5 years old, you're coming home from school, you're trying to show your parents your homework, but your parents are working or they're busy. And so it's like, okay, this signal starts of like, I'm not good enough. They're not paying attention to me. And that starts this shutdown of the gut. And it can be, disease can start right after, or disease might not happen for 60 years. And so you're 60 years old, you've got rheumatoid arthritis or Hashimoto's, and you're like, well, why did it start? And, you know, it could be as little as just like undiagnosed trauma as a kid. And that's where a therapist really helps to help uncover that and dig that out. I really like meditation. There's so many different types of meditation. For if someone's just getting started, I really like the app called Calm.
It's a great app. It's the same one I use. Fantastic app.
Thousands of meditations, 10 minutes, hour, whatever you want. Anything's better than nothing. I do a gratitude list every day with my wife. So we will say three things we're grateful for. It's a good way to turn the day around in regards to, like, I could be having a really bad day, but then just thinking, like, I'm grateful that there's sun. I'm grateful I have a roof. I'm grateful I had water to drink today. Can kind of help kind of calm things down and just kind of reflect. And then another tool that I'm still learning more about, but is amazing, is heart rate variability. So there's all these different apps that you can get now that basically send you a monitor that you connect to your finger, your ear, and you can connect it to your computer or your phone, and it tracks the variability of your heart rate. And if the variability is imbalanced, that's a sign that your vagus nerve is in overdrive. So the best way to heal your vagus nerve is through all the things we've talked about, including heart rate variability. But that's something that people can train themselves at home and do to help learn how to kind of calm down or identify that we're agitated. And beyond that, I mean, like I said, there's so many things out there that people can do. You know, I could love my therapist, but they might suck for you. It might not be the right fit, even though they have great reviews or they came recommended. You know, if that person's not getting you where you need, then you switch. You got to find someone new. So I'm very much a checklist person. So I like to write lists, and that's how I remember to get things done. I did that like with my mental, emotional, and spiritual health, and I crossed it off. I went through treatment and all of that. And then I stopped working on it and I relapsed and I went back to all my old thinking patterns. So the thing that I've learned through my own story is it's a everyday decision. Like every day is a new day to start over. And so there's good about it because you could have a really bad day and then just completely start fresh. But then it's kind of like this never ending process, in my opinion.
There's some fantastic tools there, Peter. And again, when it comes to therapy and therapists, I'm a big fan. The analogy I use for people who can normally connect with this podcast is it's similar to personal trainers in a gym. Like, just because one personal trainer is a great, or a coach, fitness coach, is brilliant for one person, might not make them a great fit for you. And I think therapists fall into that same bracket. So you experiment and you find, you know, that the analogy I use is square peg into square hole. You know, you find the person who's a good fit for you. And again, the gratitude journals, the heart rate variability, they're all fantastic tools that people can use, and stress management techniques even for those who are struggling with that area. Peter, I just have one final question, and I could talk to you for hours based on the amount of potential topics we could cover. So I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. I'm going to be going back over it myself again with a notepad and pen. But keeping with the theme of Pandora's box, that there's so many different ways we could go with this potential final question, but what's something that you know now, specifically when it comes to, say, nutrition and or functional medicine in general, that you know now that you wish you had known back when you were a resident or back in the early days? Something that will hopefully cut the learning curve for a lot of people who are listening. But, and I know they won't have the same background as you, of course, in terms of your research and your study and everything that you've gone through. But what's something that you know now that you wish you had known back then?
So this is going to maybe sound a little ridiculous, but I, as a kid growing up and even through, I'd say, medical school, just the general thought process that what I eat is going to affect the way I feel. Right. And I wasn't really taught that. Like, I grew up, for me, it was like wanting to fit in into American culture. So I wanted to eat like pizza and McDonald's and French fries and all this stuff as like a way to fit in, but not realizing that that stuff is not giving my immune system, my thyroid, my testosterone, the nutrients they need to be produced and work and survive and work normally. So it, you know, what we're putting into our, that's the only way our body has to survive, is the information, the energy that we're giving it. And if we're giving it very inflammatory energy, things aren't going to work and we're going to get sick. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's too basic and people understand that concept, but that's something that I honestly didn't know till I was older. That, like, hey, like, if you want to feel good, you got to eat nutritious foods because that's what your body needs.
It sounds so obvious, but I think I've definitely fallen victim to the same thing. And I think a lot of people listening will be in the exact same boat. We normally have a wake up call at some point where something happens, something as simple as, you know, too much acid in your stomach. For me, it was a lot of acid reflux, and that kind of set me on the journey of going down the rabbit hole on looking at gut health and potential ways to fix my issues, and then how kind of everything kind of spirals out of control first and then into control, thankfully, over the space of about 10 years. But I think what you're putting out there, Peter, the book on Unfunk Your Gut, the content here on the podcast, and just everything for people to consider when it comes to nutrition and seeing things holistically is so valuable. So thank you so much for that. Peter, where's the best place for people to pick up the book? I'll link it in the descriptions, but just any places you want to give or any links for any social media platforms or wherever people can potentially connect with you, anything you want to give now, please do.
Yeah, I think the book is available anywhere that you're buying books. So Amazon's the most common one, and it's readily available there. Whoever your favorite printing company or bookstore can order it and get it there. So it should be pretty easy to find. It is Unfunk with a C. So it's Unfunk Your Gut, but the funk is with a C. At my practice, we have a saying that says we put the funk in functional medicine. And so that's where the title came from. If people want to connect with me with more questions or get help, my website is the best way. It's got my email on there, doc-koz.com, doc-koz.com. I'm on social media, doc_koz. But those are the best ways to either my website and emailing or calling us or through social media. Those are the best ways to kind of reach out and get help. But the book is a great, great place to start. We got 50 plus recipes in there and a very kind of detailed yet simplified plan to start getting your health right.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, I will link the book and all the details that Dr. Koz, which again, I think that's the great name for social media in terms of for spelling. Again, as somebody that's a chronically bad speller, I think you really hacked that well. So I'll link it in the show notes for people on BrianKeenFitness.com, and you can click on the description wherever you're listening to podcasts, go straight on through, check out the book, check out the social media platforms, check out everything that's linked. Dr. Peter, thank you so much again for all you do, and thank you so much again for your time.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
There you have it, Dr. Peter Kozlowski on food sensitivities, fixing leaky gut, and how to do an elimination diet correctly. I loved this podcast. Again, one that's very near and dear to my heart as somebody who has a history of food sensitivities, just leaky gut, IBS, etc. Learned so much from this episode. I'm really looking forward to breaking this one down on my 3-email newsletter, my 3-takeaway newsletter every Thursday. So for those of you who listen to the podcast and want to see what my major takeaways were, every Thursday in my newsletter, I send out my top 3 takeaways. So I'm looking forward to having a reflection on this one. So to sign up for that, if you're not already, just head over to BrianKeenFitness.com, pop your email into the newsletter section, and every Thursday you will get my 3 major takeaways from every podcast episode. So looking forward, as I said, to diving into this week's one with Dr. Peter Kozlowski. That's all from me this week. Catch you all next Monday.